podcast off mic. Everyone is very warm, especially me.
Yeah, 14 degree summer in Dublin is just too hard
to deal with. It's not actually 14 degrees. What is it actually?
Uma has the White Snake stage fan going on. You're just like hair blowing in the wind.
Literally, it's drying out my eyes so much though, but worth it.
It's not to cool down, it's so you can actually see extra ultraviolet rays on the spectrum because your eyes are so dry.
Exactly, yeah. So look, what fabulous. Is it, Karen? Is it like 20 degrees in Ireland then?
It's 19.
Wow, you're so brave, Kieran, podcasting in this weather.
I refuse to go outside. It's very humid. All right. Hey. Welcome to your weekly Corner Spady. It is me, Kieran. I am joined by Uma.
Hello.
And Nick.
Hello.
And special guests. We've got, from Bloodwork, we've got Greg and Tom. Hi, how are you guys doing?
It's a Bloodwork summer. It's the Blood Boys.
Yeah, it's the Blood Boys. Yeah. Boiling, roasting, sweltering, baking. It's just currently living through the opening monologue from Sexy Beast.
Which one of us is Ben Kingsley and which one of us is Ray Winston? That's the question.
I feel like you are Ray Winston. I feel like I'm spiritually Ben Kingsley in the sense that I often get mistaken for a public schoolboy. So and Mahatma Gandhi.
And I get mistaken for a bouncer all the time.
There's got to be a bouncer podcast. Actually, I'm just riffing. There's got to be
there's every podcast, Kieran.
Yeah. Someone, I've decided to train my personal Reddit to understand the FIFA World Cup entirely through the subreddit for referees.
Kieran, for Eurovision.
This is just such a credence that Kieran was an inside child growing up.
Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? Of course I was. You're in my house. But the indoors.
Even on a bouncer podcast, I saw a video of a bar in London that is half a bar, half a podcast studio, where you sit at the bar and record a podcast with the bartender. And I will give you one guess where the person who owns this venue is from.
I did see that. I did see the reel as well, the podcast bar.
Yep.
Yeah. I saw a reel that described it as a hidden gem, and I was like, no.
No. Yeah, should stay hidden.
Or are they from Austin, Texas? Like what?
No, like, no. Think of what is the country with the worst vibes?
Israel, obviously.
Yes.
I mean, is Austin, Texas not Israeli?
They're trying with all those laws they keep making teachers sign on to or whatever.
Yeah, I've been going off with friends of mine about things that are culturally Israeli, particularly in Berlin, which I feel is a very Israeli city. Mm-hmm. Bouldering, Israeli. Polycules, Israeli.
I think this is things you just don't like.
No, okay, exactly. Yeah. Fusion Festival in Berlin, Israeli.
I mean, I would disagree that polyamory is Israeli because Israelis famously don't like sharing, so.
No. Specifically, polyamory of straight people pretending they're queer. That's Israeli.
Ah, yes.
See, thank you. Yeah.
The white people with dreadlocks of
oh my god,
queerness.
Yeah, exactly. 100%.
I had an experience when I lived in Berlin. I was down in Neukölln, and I was hanging out in a park near the river or the canal down there. And
Neukölln, Israeli.
This guy came over to me, and he was like, he was basically like the sort of skinny dreadlock German version of the Chris Farley down by the river character. He was just like, yeah, I live in a shed out in the woods, and. And then he started talking to me. He's like, yeah, I'm in a polycule. Like, I met this girl the other day. Like, she's my new girlfriend. And we're really getting along. I'm really into her. And he kept talking about these various girls that he had met and who had all become girlfriends in his polycule. Mm. And the longer he kept talking, the more I realized none of these women had any idea that they'd been incorporated into this man's polycule. This was a deranged man who lived in the woods. Just meeting women, having 5 minutes conversations, then walking
around.
No, it's so nice to make another girlfriend today.
Unfortunately, with how perverted of a city that Berlin is, this man was not lying.
Oh no, I fully believed him.
this person actually is real, and he has polycule.
The most troubling part was that I believed him.
There's one this polycule. It's called humanity.
Yeah, no, this guy's 65 years old, absolutely just like out of his mind, but is unfortunately having sex with some of the most beautiful women you've ever seen. This guy is real.
The Oprah Winfrey of the polycule. Like, you're my girlfriend. You're my girlfriend. You're my girlfriend. You're my girlfriend. I was like, all right, man, sweet. And I know the moment I walked away, he was like, I'm so glad I made a new boyfriend today.
Amorous annexation in the park by just a weird German man. Love to see it.
God damn it. All right. So unfortunately, we can't.
Speaking of a place that's also spiritually Israeli.
God damn it, that's such a good transition. We gotta talk about some we have Greg and Tom on today to talk about something that we probably should have talked about last week, but we kind of took a week off, oops, and then all the news happened. So we gotta talk about violence in Belfast, the kind of increasing violence that's been occurring across the UK, and probably more, I think, important to this show and kind of what we talk about, the politicians that are just kind of like signing off on it or giving their kind of like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, this is okay, thumbs up to all the violence. But first, I do want to just, because before the news gets away from me again, I do have to talk about the fact that this absolutely heinous migration bill passed in the European Parliament. This gives like a big old green rubber stamp to the kind of like third location, kind of like your Rwandas, your Albanias, migration detention centers. But probably most egregiously was that the European Parliament passed on this vote and then started chanting, send them back. Which is...
Grim?
Grim? I think my first...
This subtext is getting awfully loud.
Can I turn this off in settings?
Yeah, it's really not. There's not a lot of sub left in this subtext. There's very little sub in this subtext.
This is Dom text.
The thing that really just, I mean, aside from it being just very horrific, the thing that pisses me off the most about the new age of European fascism is how American it is. As the sole Usonian in the conversation right now, it's just like, it's so lame. Like it's horrific. But then you fucking see them pretty much chanting the, like, you know, lock her up or whatever the fuck Trump was doing like 8 years ago.
Yeah, there is something kind of inherently cocked about this chant being sung in English.
Yeah, right.
Like.
Yeah. But it should be done in French, the way that God intended racism to be, all right?
This comes back to a point. I was having an argument with someone last week about, you know, what happened in Belfast and about migration and stuff. And I was like, you're old enough to remember, like, how vitriolically racist everyone was against, like, Polish people and Lithuanians in the 2000s. And it's like... And they were talking about, like, all these refugees, like, coming over and getting homes and stuff. And I was like, yeah, well, like, reflexively, when you think about it, you know, there was, like, what, 200,000 Ukrainians came over during the war and, you know, they got homes and everyone's cool with it, as they should have been. And they were like, yeah, but it's different. I was like, you do realize there's, like, a war going on in, you know, Sudan and Somalia and all of these places where people are coming from. And it's like...
Counterpoint, Tom, I don't.
Well, it's just like you're absolutely talking out of your ass, and it's like the reflexive thing of, and I push them on and say, like, you think it's different because they're white, and they're like, no, that's not it. And I'm like, it fucking is, and don't be such a liar and be such a cunt that you can't admit it.
But it's the same also in England, like with the whole Henry Novak thing, like the same people that were chanting, like going out on the street saying, let, you know, justice for Henry Novak, they are the first ones that, like, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago even, were extremely racist against Polish people. They were the first ones to
ask Greg, ask the average British person about their opinion about Romanians, and then we'll see the great straddling point of who is white and who is not.
It's the same thing, you know. Again, like there's a very similar thing. I'm sure you guys have encountered it in Berlin, where like, you know, everyone's like, "Oh, it's a really great, really progressive, really cosmopolitan city. Like everyone's really great, everyone's welcome." Then you say to them, "Oh, cool. How do you feel about Turks?"
Ooh, like, yeah.
Bang. Like, I think for my like thing, what is kind of troubling or that is like noteworthy about this kind of thing is that the whole kind of like pretense or conceit of this kind of like radicalizing anti-immigrant politics across Europe over the past 20 years has kind of like depended upon a separation between the people in the streets who are the ones who are chanting, "Send them back." And then the people in the suits in, for example, the EU Parliament or in various national governments who like, are meant to perform all of this with more kind of like dignity and a little bit more like refined language. And it's kind of like, it comes from a position of triumphalism to be chanting that kind of thing. But it does also kind of reveal like what a kind of pig and a slob you are, because it's like, no, you bozo, like you're not supposed to be the person chanting that. You're supposed to be having a bit more class and dignity. Mm-hmm. And so like, you know, it does reflect like, how far advanced this has become, that kind of like, as I said, like the subtext is now rising up and just becoming the text. But it does also kind of like, again, you know, hats off, massive round of applause to all of the pigs and slobs and bozos who are in the ostensible kind of like more liberal center or like moderate wings of these various parliaments and political, like that you have allowed this to happen on your own watch and facilitated it and condoned it. And that's where you are now. Like you are surrounded by pigs and slobs, and you're all pigs and slobs.
You too have become pig.
Yeah, they're all like these people. Like I wish I had more vocabulary, but like I'm just sick of these pigs. Like they're all pigs. Like
I'm not a pig. Just because I eat from a trough and everyone else around me is a pig doesn't mean I'm a pig, right, Shirley? What are we chanting now?
Yeah.
I remember when I still lived in Dublin, I lived in Rathmines, and it was might have been like the 2019 general election. And it was like, I think it was when Justin Barrett like had just formed the National Party. And I was like standing having I was standing having a cigarette like outside my house. And there was a collection of like 8 of the most Reddit looking guys ever. Just like, they started to walk towards me and I could see they had leaflets in their hands. And I was just like, "Who are you with?" Oh, we just want to have a chat. I just went, "Fuck off." And then they just like, I was like turned and walked away. Cause it was like, I can smell it off you.
There's a real confidence in the party that when you ask them, "Who are you with?" they don't answer immediately. Yep. Yeah. So I think to kind of like combine these points of like the riffraff have entered the parliament kind of aspect of like, the pigs are here, mm-hmm. and also like the Americanness as well. Because mm-hmm. one of the other gut feelings I had to the whole "send them back" chant is kind of like, I had the same reaction of when like a toddler walks in with a gun. It's just like,
now you're speaking our language.
It's just like, you don't know what you're wielding. Like you don't know what you've got there, because I really do think all of this triggered like the whole thing of like, oh, the rest of Europe is using the European Parliament the way the British did, which is farm it for content to be used back home. That's how like Nigel mm-hmm. Farage got mm-hmm. his base. And then at the same time, it's like, oh, and then, you know, whatever, 5-10 years down the line, there's going to be a new like alternative for Deutsch Reich or something party that's saying the AfD is cucked now and we have to like come along and attack them from the right, because you'll never be able to send them back. Like you'll never do it. Like,
yeah,
it's impossible.
I have to like slightly disagree on the toddler with a gun thesis, although I appreciate the visual.
I love the visual.
I think that to me, the largest encapsulation of the like how normalized this has become was the, you know, compare and contrast of Vance's Munich Security Conference speech last year and Rubio's mm-hmm. of this year, where they said the exact same thing. And, you know, Vance, I think it's just because Vance is a fucking loser and even Europe can see through that. And they're like, oh, look at this. Look at this fucking baby. And that,
yes, at this My Chemical Romance gay boy who is VP.
Yeah, like Vance.
Someone has to dig up his MySpace page, because you know that shit was bedazzled to fuck.
Oh, 100%.
What's that? What was that thing that tracked all your plays?
Last FM.
Yeah, get his Last FM.
Find out JD Vance's Scrabbles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the reason also that like Marco Rubio and JD Vance are like cut from the same cloth in the sense that they both like have daddy issues, but like JD Vance is a fundamentally unlovable child, whereas Marco Rubio did eventually get Jeb Bush, you know, like, and he was kind of like grandfathered into the neoconservative movement. And so like, you know, Marco did eventually get like a daddy to show him like which forks to use at the table and stuff and like how to speak and sort of how to articulate himself. Whereas like JD is just a very whiny, unlovable child.
Trump said today, if the Iran stuff goes bad, I'm going to blame it on Vance.
I mean, the most alpha thing that Vance ever did was get Charlie Kirk killed so he could fuck his wife. that is the only alpha move that Vance has made. But like you were saying, the Americanness of it is really bled over, and they're kind of using the same playbook that like doesn't really translate over here. And like, I suppose maybe to transition into maybe talking about, you know, the antecedents of what happened last week. I remember last year I went to the first Tommy Robinson Unite the Kingdom march because I was like, I don't think anyone is going to have the balls to be in that crowd taking photos and marching with them. And I was like, all of them just the fuck, like, look, maybe this is a bit dismissive, but like the dregs of society and fucking morons. And like, they were all so happy to have their photo taken. As soon as I lifted up the camera, they were like beaming, waving the flags. Like a dude, I took a photo of a dude who had confused the Crusader flag with the flag for Georgia, the country. And like, he's there with like a can of Stella and is delighted. But at one point we were walking towards Parliament Square and someone had like spray painted on a wall, Tommy Robinson is Mossad. And I was like,
I mean, maybe.
Yeah.
It's like, even within this like movement of, you know, chuds who have been radicalized by Facebook AI and just like being annoyed that the corner shop guy is an Arab, like they have like ingested so much of like the American stuff that like they're also getting their like infighting tactics as well, inadvertently.
There's that, and then there's another thing, like, you know, for listeners, you know, I'm thoroughly a plastic paddy, like very much. I'm Irish by extraction, but as you can hear from my voice, like thoroughly anglicized.
You can't see the size of Greg's head.
big old Irish head. But I live in like one of the kind of like poorer, more like economically deprived parts of the UK, and having this kind of background, you have an experience where, you know, people will say things in front of you about like what is happening in Belfast, expecting you to agree or to like to be on board with them. And like, I was just in the pub. I often have it with people where I'm like, please stop talking because I think you're a nice person and I think you probably are a decent person. I just don't want to hear you say something that's going to make me think less of you. And then they go ahead and do it anyway. And so I was in the pub and I saw this guy, a nice guy, I get along with him and all that. But he was like talking about the stuff that had happened. And this was on Tuesday evening before the kind of riots had kicked off. And he's like, have you seen what's on the news? And all that kind of stuff. And I was like, no. And he's like, God, I tried to behead a guy with a Stanley knife, all that kind of stuff. And he's like, it's all going to kick off. And I was just like, eh, maybe. I was walking out and he was like, oh, too right. And the thing for me is that like, I think it really does encapsulate something about, and I think this is the broader kind of exploitation and kind of cynical leveraging of that event. When you're there and you hear like an English person cheering on the idea that there's going to be the eruption of like sectarian violence on the streets of Belfast for whatever reason, as though that is like ever been a solution or resolve things, it's just a thing where like I just hearing him say that, like I just kind of walked out of the pub and was like, the Brits have never given a shit about Northern Ireland, like just no. Fundamentally. Mm-hmm. to how ignorant you have to be to like to be proudly saying that, oh great, there's gonna be violence in Belfast, like good. I'm just like, yeah, cheers, man.
This is something that has often been like it gets a bit of traction in the Republic and the Free State of just like the news story of someone from like a unionist loyalist background moves to London and has the like coming to Jesus moment of like, oh, they don't know anything about us and they don't give a fuck.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, and you know, we it's put through Irish media because it's a little bit of yes.
A juicy morsel.
Yeah.
You know, we are the pigs at the trough. It's just a different trough.
It's a different trough. But ours is better. Hang on. No, their trough is stupid for pigs. This trough is like elevated and cool.
News reporter suddenly having the voice of Vincent Price is that reporting.
It's like that and then the other thing is like that could get as equal a reaction as like Irish man order spice bag in perfect Mandarin. Yeah.
I'm sorry, but like this is just like I'm at the trough and the waitress comes over and be like, have you dined with us before at this trough? We do things a little differently here. It's like, yes, this is the good trough.
We are all of us pigs in the swill, but some of us are lying on our backs looking at the stars.
God damn it. But it is something that I've always found deeply fascinating of this, like, because one way I'm viewing this is the kind of what has always been loyalism. Like it's also we're telling that this has kicked off like in these months. Like this is like, you know, beginning of like marching season and whatnot.
Riot season, baby. I ran the numbers. 80% of the riots in Belfast have happened within a 2 month period before or after July the 12th.
There you go.
Tom Sinner tapping away at his calculator.
I'm
like
most...
Rain Man.
Look at this spreadsheet. It measures racism. it's that kind of culture that has been kind of, I think, clinically separated from Britain, like the island, is now being brought in. And it does this whole, like, not knowing what they're dealing with does remind me of the... God, what was it? I can't remember which general election it was in the UK where like the BBC coverage had to be like, who the fuck are the DUP and why are the Conservatives got into government with them? Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, they've always been there, actually. And it's amazing you've never noticed them up until now. I just find this kind of, it's all finally merging thing.
Yeah. So fascinating. Like, so I think one thing, and for those of you who don't know, I suppose who me and Greg are, we do a podcast called Bloodwork. We recently finished a series. It's a four-part series about Combat 18, who were like a neo-Nazi football hooligan gang who wanted to start a white ethno-state in Essex. And also there was a wizard who was a member. Don't post about the wizard. He will be in your mentions. He is the most annoying man on the planet. But essentially, they grew out of a genesis of... So the National Front in the 70s was a kind of wouldn't even really be considered that far right now, but like very much in that Mosley-esque, you know, Britain for the British. We want all of the Windrush generation out of the country. And they suffered like a insane electoral defeat. And then there was a schism that then birthed the British National Party. And the difference between the National Front and the BNP is that the BNP really tapped into like far right groups, be they, you know, in the skinhead music scene, in the football hooligan scene, who are generally extremely far right. If for Uma and Nick and Kieran, if you want to just Google the Chelsea Headhunters flag for a second,
I no need.
I'm doing it.
I want to get Kieran and Uma's reaction.
It's a logo that you've seen before, Kieran. Let's just say that.
To be fair, they got that flag while they were at a tattoo parlor in Croatia and they didn't know what it was at the time.
I hear their
Senate campaign's now going really well.
Have you seen it?
People get mad at me in either direction for making that joke, and I don't care. I don't live in Maine. Get over it.
Yeah. So, And you had these like two simultaneous groups of, you know, the white power skinhead scene, which was kind of headed by a guy called Ian Stuart Donaldson, who was the lead singer of Screwdriver, whose greatest hit was his car hitting a tree. And then after, you also then had the football hooligan scene, and there was a kind of like a little bit of crossover in it, but it really in the mid to late 80s into the 90s when you had these groups kind of formalize once cash was coming in. And like Gareth Watkins said on the series, like someone like Will Browning, who was a key member of Combat 18, he got like a council house in Bermondsey with a 0% deposit down mortgage, like a 2-bed house.
Advertised in the Evening Standard, like no money down, like
yeah,
life on, like, easy mode.
Yeah, all of these guys, as Gareth, you know, accurately assessed, were like living life on easy mode and were dead set on making it everyone else's problem. So through various factors of, you know, assaults, attempted murders, imprisonment or whatever, Combat 18 fizzled out, but the people who were like members of it or associated with it were still around. And that's how you get like the genesis of something like the EDL and Tommy Robinson, where he originated from the football hooligan scene in Luton. And the EDL was like, you know, Luton was starting to become less white and they didn't like that. And then as you move into the 2000s, you have a much more organized, essentially fascist network of people who are like part of, you know, different, you know, football hooligan firms or part of the music scene. And then with the birth of like social media, and we spoke about this on the show, when something like Elon Musk taking over Twitter, these people then had access directly into people's minds rather than having to hand out leaflets or like sell CDs at a gig and like try and convince people, despite the fact they were like appalling people. They can like have like a Roman statue profile picture on Twitter and like espouse this stuff that goes directly to your phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And for the most part, like unionism and loyalism in Northern Ireland was, you know, heavily influential on these groups. Like Combat 18 were like heavily influenced by Northern Ireland and unionism and like essentially trying to create a ethno state. And they also kind of were like, let's start it in Essex. But what has happened is that it's come full circle in that, you know, in the 90s, Combat 18 were helping supply weapons to like the UDA in Northern Ireland. Mm. And now what has happened is after the Good Friday Agreement and like the country has started to move on, these groups are now struggling to find relevance within their communities. And therefore, by agitating against migration and starting riots and all this sort of stuff, they keep that, you know, the dream alive, that, you know, the fundamental identity of Northern Ireland is being undermined, except instead of, you know, being Catholics, it's now someone else. Anyway, Greg, what do you think?
Yeah, so I have like a few thoughts. Like on that note, one of the things that Tom would be able to speak a bit more about at length is that following the Good Friday Agreement, you know, a lot of these loyalist paramilitaries kind of like lost their raison d'etre, and like, you then get this transition to drug trafficking and other kind of black market activities, sex trafficking, things like that. They are still very much present, and they're very much there. And I think anybody who knows the history of like the Troubles knows that like a lot of these loyalist paramilitaries were like interwoven with, shot through, collaborating with, or receiving assistance from the state, the British military, Royal Ulster Constabulary, and so on. What has happened is, the loyalist groups have now found a way to like re-imbue themselves with a sense of, with a raison d'etre in the form of like anti-immigration. And so like there are now, for example, like murals and posters like showing up in sort of like loyalist communities in Northern Ireland, like saying like Islam is a doctrine spawned in hell, a new evil has arisen. Like Churchill was right, Enoch Powell was right, Pastor McConnell was right in 2014. Like
at least, you know, the old school UDA posters like had some like graphic design principles. All this shit is just AI generated now.
Yeah, and there was also a poster I found, which was from the East Belfast Battalion, which just said, "The prevention of the erosion of our identity is now our priority." Like, mm-hmm. So I think that like makes it very clear. I think on the note of the Combat 18 connection, you know, as Tom said, like Combat 18 had a lot of like connections. They were like fellow travelers with a lot of these loyalist paramilitary groups, both on the British mainland and Northern Ireland, as Tom said, like assisting with like drug running, gun running, things like that, and particularly the UDA. Now, there were strategic and tactical reasons for them doing this, such as obviously potential access to weapons and training and materials for carrying out of attacks. But it was also because they felt like a deep affinity for loyalists in the simple fact that like these were people who were like virulent British nationalists who made extensive use of terroristic violence and were willing to use that violence to advance a sectarian separatist politics. But equally, like by the end of the 80s, you know, like the National Front had kind of been sort of humiliated and was on the way out. The BNP was still in a very like germinal phase. One of the reasons that Combat 18 became very fond of like the Chelmsford Aryan homeland model that they were looking for was because, and this is real, guys, they bought a flat in Essex to them. Two dickheads, two brothers bought a flat in Chelmsford in Essex in the 90s and were like, we're going to build a separatist white enclave here. But it was explicitly modeled on the sectarian enclaves of Belfast. And it was a thing where they were like, that is like the idea for them of these kind of like economically and politically crippled territories in like a developed country, which had lost decades of like political, social and economic development to like sectarian violence. That was their utopia. But the reason for that was at that time, the prior ideal or the prior dream of the far right in the UK of mass deportation and mass expulsion of like non-whites and immigrants, that as far as they were concerned, that was a dead letter. They were like, we have, and like they were even writing newsletters and publishing zines where they were like, our number one enemy right now is not like even the blacks or the reds or the commies or anything like that. They're like, our number one enemy is like in very MLK senses, they're like, it's the white moderate. Like it's white people who are our enemies because they're all too accepting of migrants and we're not going to win that battle. Mm-hmm. So I say all of that to say that like, I think it really does put quite a fine point on where we are now. That what you are seeing now, like you said, with the chanting in the EU Parliament and these like anti-migrant pogroms that are now being ginned up with regularity in the United Kingdom. This is the return of an originary vision, which at one point in history, 30 years ago, like the radical far right in the UK, for example, had abandoned because they saw it as unfeasible. And thanks to the assistance of whether it is like an establishment politician like Nigel Farage, or like, should we say like an insurgent populist politician like Nigel Farage, mainstream politicians like Theresa May with the hostile environment, or Keir Starmer more recently with language about islands of strangers, you know, this has been a 20, 30 year project, including the collaboration assistance of the media, in which what was once like an abandoned dead letter of the far right has now become back on the table. And I think that is something that is really worth dwelling on, that like this isn't something new in UK politics. It's actually the return, and like it's a really important question to ask is how it came back and by what means.
And I think just the last point to add on to that, hopefully, you know, most of your listeners have maybe been to Northern Ireland, have been to Belfast specifically, and you know, the curio of why is there so many Israeli flags around? And, you know, a lot of people think it's like, oh, you know, it's because, you know, Catholics identify with the Palestinian struggle and stuff like that. But it goes kind of beyond that because, you know, for unionists and loyalists, it's like a deep affinity for the besieged mentality of Israel, that like they are surrounded by enemies and they are, rather than being, you know, an exclave that is an outcrop of like a global religion and a nation for people of that religion, so that no, we are like surrounded as an exclave by our enemies, and if they win, we cease to exist. And it's the exact same thing. And it's ironic that there was a thing going around the other day, like during the riots, you know, American fascists and morons were like, oh, you know, the fucking Doherty clan are coming. And I'm like, and it's like, if you fucking said to these people they were Irish, they would not be happy. But ironically, someone found the quote from Ian Paisley saying like, he is Irish, whether, you know, definitionally is like, I am an Ulster man, I am an Irish man, but I am also a unionist. And it's like, it's just this intellectual and kind of like historical quango that people find themselves in, that this situation just a paradox upon a paradox.
And also like on the topic of like the involvement of like loyalist groups, and Tom can speak a bit more about sort of the intricacies and details of this. Like one of the things that I was sort of had learned while I was doing some reading for this episode, the victim of this attack, Stephen Ogilvie, the man who was attacked by this Sudanese migrant, he was actually in the news 25 years ago, because in 2001, while he was living in Scotland, he was basically drugged with GHB and doused in aftershave and set on fire by a drug dealer who was associated with like a unionist gang, or like an Ulster gang, loyalist gang. So like, again, in terms of the cynicism of this, like the idea, this is a man who at a previous point in his life had been a victim of like Ulster loyalist, like drug gang violence. And then 25 years later, those same people are now coming out and tearing out the street as though they are his defender. And so like, you know, one of the, two kind of metaphors that I think you can use to think about a lot of what is happening in kind of like far right politics right now is like one hand washing the other, or like the self-licking ice cream cone. Because like another reason, for example, that there has been increased unionist and loyalist like violence in Northern Ireland since the 2020s is because of Brexit and the Northern Ireland protocol, which has now, as we all know, has like put a de facto border in the Irish Sea between Northern Ireland and the mainland. And needless to say, like loyalists and unionists are not happy about that. They do not like the idea that there being like any kind of separation. And so the person who is now going on TV and cheering them on and saying good for you, and politicians like him, like Nigel Farage, he is the architect or the progenitor of the policy which has now inflamed these unionists and made them feel more separated from the mainland. It was him that did that. And then at the same time, he's then, like I said, self-licking ice cream cone, like one hand washes the other. He gets it both ways. And like, you know, Tom, the story Tom said about like being approached by like, you know, some leafleters in Dublin and just saying like, fuck off. Like my, you know, one of the kind of refrains that I have had to like repeat so many times over the past few months is that like so much of this stuff could have been avoided if at any point in the past 30 years, like anybody within the sort of like centrist, mainstream, liberal establishment or institutions, including the BBC, but also like mainstream politicians and mainstream papers, had just said like, fuck off. Like it cannot be stressed enough. The only way that like somebody as like cynical and incoherent as Nigel Farage can continue to rehabilitate and remake himself and repeat this process over and over and over again is because people are allowing him to do so.
Mm-hmm.
For what reason?
I do think it's also just, I'll let you speak, Nick, but it's very easy to stop Nigel Farage in his tracks because of that whole like RT just to play that like Chucky R. Law cameo clip at him once, and he just went into stunned silence. Like he actually can't handle any form of pushback. He just never gets it.
But this is why, you know, Nigel Farage, like his whole political raison d'etre is to like appear like, you know, a strong and shrewd operator. And it's like when you push back on him even slightly on like something that he can't like use rhetoric to get out of, he just completely crumbles. Like playing, you know, a Chucky Garla like cameo that he did, there's no way to respond to that because it exposes his opportunism. Anyway, Nick, what were you gonna say?
Oh no, just to the thing that I always find very interesting with the like rise of this like British neo-Nazism in like, you know, the 80s and 90s or whatever, is that the thing that always comes to my mind, which I think can encapsulate also how like incredibly influential this was, is that then the German neo-Nazi movement of the 90s is not a German creation. It is literally mirroring exactly what is happening in the UK and in the United States at this time. You know, particularly there's the sense of, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall, you know, East and West coming into one country, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this doesn't just simply stay confined into the UK. And I think the thing that's also very, you know, what we've seen this week with, you know, the Americanization of the far right and this and that and that, is that then it's like to the point that you made about that, it's like no one over these last 30 years has told any of these people just to shut the fuck up. It's a massive European problem now. You know, I mean, like the AfD currently is polled this week at 29% as the highest, as the most popular party in Germany for exactly the same reason. You know, the normalization of then, you know, what happened in Rostock, for example, in the 90s with the like the so-called baseball bat years, where you have then like the football hooligans that then, you know, terrorize people and so on and so forth. There is a direct connection between that group of people and, of course, then the modern day AfD. And throughout all of that, all we have then now seen in Germany has been inviting them on to talk shows and, you know, this height, not even just like the general sense of like, oh, you know, the media has gotten more right wing, which is obviously a massive part of it, but that the AfD is like massively allowed to then take part within the political discussion at this point. And sure, yeah, maybe the like most extreme wings of them will get a slap on the hand and told that they're illegal for 3 seconds and then get to like rebuild themselves. But everything that then is been described here, I can just see copy and pasted in a slightly different variant to then the exact same thing happening in Germany. And it is
so,
the feedback is also insane. The influence goes both ways. You're right. Like the 90s German neo-Nazi stuff was copying, pasting the Britain. But then like Le Grand Replacement used to be like a crank French thing. And now it's like everywhere. Mm-hmm. Martin Zellner has really gotten the whole term remigration off the ground. And like, I think when we started this podcast, I think Martin Zellner would have like, I think you would have asked me and I was like, oh, he's washed now. He's gone. Like, because he was getting like banned from most countries or whatever. But like, no, he's still there in the shadows. Like,
And I like think there has to be asked as well, like, what is the functional difference? So like, ultimately, what is the functional distinction between these, you know, whether it was the Plan Rwanda, like in the United Kingdom, or this now plan to sort of roll out that sort of third country deportation continent wide across the EU versus like Donald Trump just kidnapping migrants and sending them to CECOT in El Salvador. You know, like, what is functionally the distinction there? And why would one be perceived to be abhorrent while the other one to be perceived to be sort of functional and upstanding and correct? And that's something that, like, again, I think there's a lot of questions that people need to be asking themselves right now, you know?
And I would actually push back on what you said, Nick, in that I think there has always been like this strange synthetical relationship between neo-Nazis in America and in the UK and in Europe as well, because, you know, you had people like Robert Matthews being like super influential in the British far right in this sort of like leaderless resistance. And a lot of the kind of the, not necessarily rhetoric, but the reading lists were being brought to the UK. The difference between America and the UK is that the UK was experienced like ground level, street level organized violence, in that, you know, you had groups of skinheads and other neo-Nazis that were marching with the BNP as security pretty much, because the failure of the National Front and like kind of popular resistance who's on the street, they had to, oh, we need tough people to fight back, because, you know, the type of people who are organizing the BNP aren't the street fighting type. So you need some cunts from the terraces who are going to nut people. Mm-hmm. And similarly, you know, when you had the development of like the Hammerskin Nation in America, which was like a model of like skinhead group that spread across America that was based on, you know, UK skins and was very much attached to the music scene, they were adopting that model of kind of like organized street violence. And then how that then works into continental Europe is through the music scene, that these people are touring, they're playing underground venues, they're selling CDs, and they're not just selling CDs, they're selling books that, like, if a single police officer walked into the venue, it's like everyone in here is getting arrested.
Yeah, yeah. No, I didn't mean it in the sense of that like, I maybe there was a misunderstanding. I mean, like, the sense
I'm just being a prick.
No.
Uber, I mean, would you like to ask a question? You haven't said anything all podcast.
Just simply in the sense of that I feel that just like that, you know, people assume that then, because, you know, Nazism is a German invention, that neo-Nazism actually, as you mentioned, comes from this, you know, the music scene, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think we're saying the same thing. I may have just worded it.
Comes weirdly from the victors of World War II.
Yeah, right?
But it's like, you know, there's so many strains that are all feeding together in that, you know, like, you have opportunist mercenaries, you know, going to Rhodesia. You have people who are like running mail order networks of like supplying magazines and books that are like trading in like illegal pornography that are also selling like far right material in the back of magazines. And it's all of these people are communicating in these kind of almost subterranean networks that like kind of all know each other. And I suppose to come back to the kind of original thing of that we're talking about, the riots last week, is that the thing that I found really fascinating about it, and it's been bubbling up over the past couple of years, is like this cross-border and cross-cultural far right that is like people who are quote-unquote Irish Republicans marching with, you know, British unionists and like people like Tommy Robinson and this weird syncretic fucking front of many colors of the biggest cunts on the planet, like, who 30 years ago would have all hated each other. And the thing that is uniting them now in a way that I think is the success of American far-right rhetoric is that American far-right rhetoric, as it is diffused and disseminated through platforms and to people, it starts to lose quite a lot of the sting. So then it appeals to more people and more people can buy into it. And the same thing kind of happened is that like the the core idea of the fundamental identity of Britain is being undermined through migration. That is a really easy thing to sell to people, regardless of what side of the border or what side of the wall, you know, they live in Belfast, or what side of the border they live in between Northern Ireland and the Republic.
Yeah.
Way to grind it to a standstill. I'm sorry.
But no, like another thing that I'm thinking about as well is that, you know, we saw this in the early years of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, when like there was a lot of questioning about why there were these far right militias sort of being integrated into the Ukrainian military. And there is a fairly like reasonable explanation for that, which is that like if you are facing a war, like you want people that you believe are going to fight for the country and really fucking mean it. And so like, yeah, whether we like it or not, like in times of like war and conflict, like you want to have a couple of nationalists and far right people on your side, because you're betting that they're more likely to fight than all the sort of bourgeois effete liberals and so on. Mm-hmm. And something that's been going through
who has read Mark Fisher is throwing a brick.
Exactly. They're just throwing a copy of Nick Land's fucking tongue.
I'm the only person who's read Mark Fisher who's throwing a brick.
throwing the hardback cover of K-Punk. but like, you know, I don't think it sort of needs to be stressed too heavily that like throughout history, Northern Ireland, like most colonies, was functioned as like a laboratory for its colonial power, Britain. You know, it's its oldest colony. Like land and labor were used as coal for the twin furnaces of colonialism and imperialism. It was one of the first spaces in which like the tools and techniques and technologies of those projects were put to use and perfected. Mapping, anglicization, geospatial processes and racial processes, all these things. Frank Kitson, counterinsurgency, asymmetrical warfare, guerrilla street warfare, all these things were like tested out, perfected, and the use of pseudo gangs and sort of, you know, para-state armed groups and violent groups. This has a long history. I think you can talk about loyalism, and I think that is like an important part of the conversation, but I also think you have to like be careful not to exceptionalize like loyalist unionism to the detriment of paying attention to like British nationalism. And like one of my kind of like sort of tinfoil hat theories that I've had over the past half decade is that like as you hear British politicians being like, we're going to be going to war in like 10 to 15 years, and I see this like sort of acquiescence and sort of passive cultivation of like an increasingly sort of radical and rabid far right and nationalist far right in the UK. And I'd like, there is part of me that suspects that like, I think they're making a bad bet, but I think they're making a bet that like, these are the people who are going to get up and fight for the country. And like, I think if you look at the way they speak to Keir Starmer, for example, they're like, we would never fucking fight for you. Like I said, I think they're making a bad bet. But with regards to what we're seeing now, you know, the spreading, like someone said earlier this week, that like prior to this Raise the Colours operation in the United Kingdom, where people were hanging Union Jack flags on motorway overpasses and lampposts and painting red crosses onto roundabouts or whatever, like
even the Grinch is far right now.
Even the Grinch is far right now. Follow me on Blue Sky to learn why. But like this, they just pointed out like that. But prior to that operation, like if you were to walk into a neighborhood and see that kind of stuff, like the only place you'd see it, you'd be like, oh shit, I'm in a loyalist neighborhood. Like it is. So there is this kind of transmutation of that kind of like ethos or whatever, like out onwards. And like I said, it's not to say that the Brits need help in being sort of like bigoted pig Nazis, but like, you know, it's nice to have a model or a laboratory. And like what I'm like looking at now, again, I see like another form of laboratory in the sense of like, you know, Belfast has historically been quite like economically underdeveloped compared to the rest of the United Kingdom, like GDP per capita, everything is much lower. And there's this kind of thing of like, how far can you like push people and sort of like denigrate, sort of dismantle the state and social welfare and social safety nets and stuff while like keeping people bound together through like projects of sort of like ethno-nationalism, like flag rallying. And like... And again, it goes back to what we said about like far right groups in the 90s idolizing and venerating like loyalist paramilitaries and stuff, because like they really liked the idea of like these are people who live in their own sort of separate sectarian enclaves, and they're willing to fight and kill and go out into the enemy territory and just like slit a Catholic's throat to prove a point. And I do think that like part of this as I said, there have been other events prior to this, but I do think that individuals like Tommy Robinson and Nigel Farage like look at what is happening or what was happening, and they see a test case to be like, how could we make this work and how can we make this, how can we then like roll this model out across the rest of the United Kingdom?
I mean, it's the classic like blood in the streets thing. But also I saw a clip of a certain very popular Twitch streamer talking about Protestants in Northern Ireland, and I was like,
not good.
Speaking of pigs, and I was just like, I think it's such an ignorant way to look at it, because, you know, what has happened and the situation now has actually been like a decades long project that goes back to, you know, the 50s, where manufacturing jobs were still quite plentiful in Northern Ireland and young Protestant men were encouraged to leave school to go work in factories. What happens when those jobs go away? They're still encouraged to leave school. You create cycles of economic deprivation. Now the highest level of education achievement or attainment in Northern Ireland is Catholic girls. The lowest is Protestant boys. And you create these cycles of poverty, undereducation, deprivation. And like every year there's stories about, you know, loyalist gangs, leveraged drug debt that was owed to them by young people to get them to come and riot, or they are trapping women in, you know, sexual exploitation because of debt. And they're just creating these cycles that continue to repeat. And then over time, you can indoctrinate someone to believe the same things you do. And then suddenly you just have the next generation of people who are going to, you know, keep the fight going strong. I'm going to use my soundboard, which I have, so they can all scream, Ulster says no.
And it's also, and again, like just to sort of really underscore the point or underline the point with what Tom is pointing out there about like, you know, decades of economic deprivation and kind of like cascading effects of kind of like alienation and falling out. Like what has to be stressed about an individual like Nigel Farage or any of these other people who are like exploiting this thing, like none of these people are going to help you. None of these people have any plans for you. None of them have anything to offer you. And it's like, it is as true for conservatives in the 2010s. It is as true for like Starmer's Labour. It is as true for like Rupert Lowe and Restore. Like as far as the sort of like political economic consensus, like regarding the model that got us here, they are all in agreement with it. And they all just, they don't have any kind of critique. Like if they were to mark their own homework, you know, for the past 40 years, they would all give themselves full marks. And so, you know, like, none of these people have any plans or anything for you. But what they can do, as I said, is like continue to push you and push you and push you and push you to the edge, but then keeping you cohered to some kind of project through like flag rallying and nationalism. And that is part of the experiment. How hard can I fuck you while continuing to keep you allied to me by getting you to rally around the flag and letting you like literally set fire to some cars, kick in some people's windows and do a pogrom every 6 months or every 12 months? Like that's the plan they have for you.
Because this is like, I always find Northern Ireland interesting in this regard, because it's like, you talk about these manufacturing jobs that were available in the 50s, and like, that's why Northern Ireland is a part of the UK to begin with. It was the part of the island where Irish people were legally allowed to touch machines. Like, and that's like why they took it. Like, it's because this is the rich manufacturing part of the island. And
a lot of people don't know Protestants have nimble hands. That's why they were,
you know,
good at
chunky,
you know,
sausage fingers. We can't.
Yeah, the big spud eating heads, yeah. You know, all the potatoes and cabbage and stuff. It just like gives you big, you know, bloated fingers.
The most sophisticated machine we can operate is some sort of
a shovel,
a specialized butter churn that's been made for us.
Ireland is run by big Kerrygold.
Yes.
It's not the Rothschilds, it's whoever owns Kerrygold.
The first chapter of fucking...
The Fenian conspiracy is real.
Sins of Our Fathers by Conor McCabe, the first chapter, the political economy of Ireland, is about cows. not for fucking nothing. But, so that was taken, and it's like, okay, now those manufacturing jobs have gone away, and it has left to the cycles, and then if we're looking at, like, you know, Nigel Farage and Tommy Robinson, like, how do we franchise this? It was like, well, Northern Ireland is not unique in the nation of the UK in this story. This describes huge parts of Scotland, Wales, and the north of England, southwest of England as well, even. And it's like, well, shit, they might have something here. We've already aesthetically made it look like a loyalist area of Northern Ireland with all the flags going everywhere. But, like, also, the whole Protestant discussion thing is very funny, because at the same time, like, I know there's been oversimplified discussions of Protestants, but at the same time, I'm getting really annoyed of like mainstream media in Ireland kind of like shutting down the whole conversation because they're afraid of being remotely sectarian. And it's just like, no one's willing to acknowledge, like, it's kind of this thing where they like they believe it's the Protestants' fault, but they can't acknowledge it because they know it's bad. Yeah. It's like they don't have the deeper analysis and they don't want to have the conversation of a deeper analysis.
Yeah, that's why they don't want to say publicly that Irish, you know, Catholics people's eyes are farther apart and Protestants are closer together. And like, if you get the ruler out, you can tell straight away.
Yeah.
That's why you come for this hard hitting journalism at the most Catholic podcast, Corner Speak.
This is why we need to, and you know, I think one of the brilliant successes of NECAP as a group is showing like cross cultural support for like a better hope, more hopeful future where people can like exist together. And the recognition that like, you know, Catholic or Protestant, you're all kind of being fucked by the same people. And, you know, that the differences between like East and West Belfast aren't that different. You know, there is obviously a religious and like a very, very historical difference between the communities, but like shows that like, you know, that can be overcome and people can work together. And when they won that grant money from the court case against the British government, they split it evenly between the two communities. Mm. And it showed that like there is a hope that really motivates people to band together. And what I propose is, you know, to fight against the rising fascist tide in Europe is that collectively we should all band together against the Greeks or the Turks, and we will take a common vote on who we target. I mean, the ECB already fucked the Greeks, you know, 15 years ago. So I think it's the Turks' time.
Yeah, we got the playbook. The infrastructure is already set up.
Yeah.
I don't know how we can take this at Corner Spati, the Greek Catholic podcast, but...
No, what we need to do is we need to propagate a lie that all of the veneers people are getting, there's actually microchips in them that Israel is tracking your movements through.
What do you mean? That probably already exists. If I scroll on Instagram for 3 seconds, I'll find some dipshit esoteric Nazi talking about that. Mm-hmm. Who also
it's
has
not wide open space.
Absolutely.
Surely. Yeah. Like,
Who's the copywriter for the far right? They need to like put in some work. You know, they're not doing the Don Draper thing. You know,
just big graph that shows like hair transplants amongst footballers going up, and then also another line going up that says woke. And I'm just like, come on,
no. When they're deciding when they're deciding what Instagram reels to make that day, they just have a giant dartboard that has a Star of David and the continent of Africa on it, and they just close their eyes and throw it, and whichever one it hits is like, okay, we're doing that today.
Oh, god damn it.
Anti-Semitism is bad. Do not think that that is an endorsement of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, we have to. Yeah,
as we say every week on Corner
every Spady. Week on the German Greek Catholic podcast, Corner Spady.
Yeah, this is why I don't let Tom speak on Bloodwork.
Next week's guest is Dykeir Stürmer to talk about, you know, how our greatest ally Israel must be protected.
I think one other thing that just I wanted to share as well on the kind of like Northern Irish context is, you know, this is supposedly or ostensibly this was kicked up through fear about mass migration. The author Seamus O'Reilly had a very good piece in the New Statesman where he basically like picks apart this narrative and kind of shows that actually immigration to Northern Ireland has been vanishingly small for decades now, piddlingly small. But there is, again, like there is an underlying sort of demographic context in the sense that according to the 2021 census, that was the first year that Catholics outnumbered Protestants in Northern Ireland. And so a lot of like working class loyalists who had long defined themselves through that dominant position are now beginning to experience like existential loss. It's also, I believe, a similar thing in terms of like the gerrymandering of the six counties being gerrymandered in such a way to permanently... foreclose the idea of Sinn Féin or like Republican parties like gaining power or authority in Northern Ireland. That scale has also tipped. And so, you know, like I said, it's a little of column A, it's a little of column B. Like it certainly is the influx of, and a little of column C as well, it is the influx of American...
Column C sort of like, being Catholic.
Yeah, American Elon Musk social media internet AI slop Nazism. It is like British far right Nazism or like far right fascist kind of politics as a way of papering over like structural abandonment and the dismantling of the state. And then it is also like as I said, like loyalism, the loyalist groups, they never really went away. The loyalist paramilitaries never went away. They always sort of kept, you know, on the back stove, like on a low heat, because groups like that are useful for the state. You know, having people who are armed and are willing to use violence in the name of your flag with like varying levels of distance or separation from the state and from the military, those are useful. You can use them sometimes. And this anti-migrant kind of thing is a useful cover in terms of like legitimating their return and resurgence in violence. And it is also, I think it is rooted in a kind of a genuine sort of domestic, like homegrown anxiety about the position of loyalist groups. And also, this is another instance in which it is possible for these groups to kind of have it both ways. Because one of the things that I've seen being reported on as well in this context was, yes, as Tom has pointed out, like there are reports that if not the gangs themselves, like people who are affiliated with, perhaps indebted to the gangs, are being mobilized, leveraged to go out and participate in these riots. But there are open questions about whether the gangs, the leaders themselves, are actually ordering them. And so what is happening is, on the one hand, there's the loyalist paramilitaries, the ones who are coordinating these sort of vigilante pogroms or whatever. And equally, some of the leaders are being like, actually, we have told all of our people to not be involved, and we have nothing to do with this whatsoever. So what this actually is a sign of the disorder that you get when you do not allow us to function, or you do not respect us and do not give us our fair court. So they get to have it both ways, you know? And again, this is a constant thing in terms of like far right paramilitaries and their relation or utility to the state. Like they can be simultaneously there or not. Like, yeah, it's us doing it, and that's how threatening and dangerous we are. Or it's not us. We're not there, but don't you wish we were?
Yeah.
And like, it's...
Yeah.
Perfect when, time like, to plug our URL, operationglad.io, mind you.
Yeah. I loved when the Italians were doing it. It's like, this is the communists that are blowing everything up. And then like all the stuff happens in Belgium. It's like, it's whoever blowing it up. Just get freaked out.
Don't worry about the stuff blowing up or the pedophiles. Listen, you know, just don't worry about it. It'll all go away.
Oh, God. I
I do
real fucking buzzkill.
I do have something kind of like highbrow and intellectual, a little passage I could read to you if you like.
Don't read Bertolt Brecht again.
Oh, I'm not reading Brecht.
That you're allowed to do that on the German Greek Catholic podcast. We'll allow it.
No, as long as you say "Go White Sox" at the end, just to make it Catholic.
Alberto Toscano had an essay in communistpress.com. The essay is called "Vectors of Fascism," and it's like an interview, and it was very good. And there's just like two paragraphs here, which I think, in terms of what we talked about earlier with like the EU and send them back and these migration laws, and similarly, like Keir Starmer and the British Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, doing that thing of being like, you need to go along with my anti-migrant crackdowns, because if you don't go along with what I'm doing, like, you're not going to like the guide that comes next. These are just like two paragraphs from Alberto Toscano, and he's speaking in the context of Ruth Wilson Gilmore. But I think this is really, really instructive, or like germane to the discussion. A fundamental lesson is that any serious anti-fascist critique must adopt a kind of parallax perspective. Of course, the explicit mobilization of far-right ideologies and sentiments is significant, but it must be analyzed in relation to the changes in the political economy of the state and its forms of differential violence. And these forms often persist from one political regime to the next, regardless of the ideological positions espoused by those in power. Gilmore's distinction between the state and the government is particularly important here. It allows us to conceive of the continuity of a racial capitalist state beyond shifts in political leadership. This is clearly evident when we look at examples in both the United States and Europe, Frontex operations, or the way in which explicitly reactionary, even fascist-leaning projects rely on state capacities that were often developed by liberal or social democratic governments. Here's a good bit. These are very revealing moments. For example, when centrist officials claim, but we've deported more people and we've done it humanely, we see how liberal governance can present itself as more effective in fulfilling the functions of the racial state, whereas fascistic policies seek instead to highlight and intensify the spectacle of violence itself. In this sense, liberal discourse presents these practices as unfortunate necessities, while fascistic discourse openly asserts them as the very goal of politics. And this creates a tension. The liberal critique of the far right often consists of arguing that it is ineffective in performing functions that liberalism itself carries out more effectively. The far right's response, essentially, is to say, we are merely making explicit what you were already doing.
Bosh.
Sorry, yeah, no. Sorry to get all highbrow. This is what happens if you have a little bit of dead air with me. But like, I was literally reading that yesterday, and it's been spinning around my head the whole time since. And I think that, like, yeah, that really does kind of.
I think the thing that then really ties that. I mean, I literally was on the train today, and on the lovely Berliner Fenster, whatever the new thing that they have up. The hit story of the day was that the newest deportation center in the BER airport is finished. So there is not a more perfect allegory.
They built that one quickly.
Yeah,
took
right.
The airport fucking 10 years or whatever.
So, yeah, I mean, like, the perfect encapsulation of exactly that has been, I mean, like, Europe as an entity, as an entirety of then like the archipelago of concentration camps, the deportations that have been going on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, have all been in place before the far right took on and had its big wave in the mid 2010s, and here we are now. You know, thank you, Friedrich Merz. I don't see really a difference between you and the AfD. So does it really matter if you're at 20% and the AfD is at 29%? Probably, but you know,
this goes in the UK. This goes all the way back. I mean, and it goes back even further still, of course. But you know, in the UK, it goes back to New Labour in the early 2000s, and back then it was bogus asylum seekers and asylum seekers, and you know, this is one of those stories where you, like, as I say, it really has to be stressed that, like, all of these individuals or the parties or the factions within those parties that they represent, like, these people have advanced specifically these policies and this, like, paradigm for decades now. And over again, they have said, like, this is what has to be done. This is what we need to do to make things better. If we don't do it, things are going to get worse. And the thing you have to ask yourself, you have to sit there and look at them and say, give them a grade. How do you think they've done?
I mean,
because they've had plenty of time and plenty of indulgence to do this, and telling you that this is the thing that can fix it. And we have to listen to these people and their various legitimate concerns. They've been doing it for 30 years. How do you think they're doing?
I mean, the fundamental, you know, cancer at the heart of liberalism is that, like, they are very happy to, like, load the bullet into the chamber of the gun as long as, you know, someone on the right shoots you with it, and then they can say, well, we didn't shoot you. We just, like, we didn't shoot you. The bullet shot you. Who fired it?
Yeah. Guns do kill people actually, not people. It was the guns' fault.
It's back to we're going against John LaJoey.
Yeah, we've been looking into this, and it's true.
Yeah. With that, I think this is a good place to wrap it. Greg, Tom, where can our listeners find you?
You can find me online, posting shit tweets on Blue Sky and shit. At got
posting
it
posting shit tweets on Blue Sky is a great sentence.
At got it at Guyanese. You can find me on Instagram. My Instagram handle is scamgolden, because I am a shit photographer, so it's GOLDIN. You can listen to our show, Bloodwork. You can post about our show with at bloodwork.show. Post a picture of your favorite gun. If you have a favorite footballer who has pointed a gun, or a favorite politician, you can find them. When we saw the picture of Macron with that, like, insane sci-fi gun, it was like, this is incredible. But yeah, listen to Bloodwork. We did the 4-part series on the history of the AK-47 and a 4-part series on the history of Combat 18. So if you like guns or stupid neo-Nazis murdering each other, you can check it out. Or Afghan War Rugs, you can listen to that one for free.
That was a good one. I listened to that one.
At bloodwork.show on Blue Sky, at bloodwork.show on Instagram, at bloodwork.show on Twitter, bloodwork.show for the Patreon, to the tune of Billy Joel's Uptown Girl, Bloodwork Show. Now you're listening to Bloodwork Show. I want to listen at the Bloodwork Show. I'm not going to stop.
Flexing all your guns on all your hoes.
I got a show. It's called Bloodwork Show.
This episode of Brush Baby has been taken down from YouTube because that was just too good a rendition. DMCA copyright struck.
Let's go back to doing the safe thing, posting guns and threatening people.
Yeah.
Named threats against people.
Kieran, need I remind you, I still need you to Photoshop me specifically with an AK-74 with the picture of my cat. So.
Oh, yes. Yeah, thank you. I'll get on that. I'm a good friend. Now, if nothing else,
now
we will catch you on the bonus feed, which we'll do a lighter episode or something because, oh boy.
Oh yeah, thank you for having us, by the way. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Me, myself and Greg spent 5 hours in the pub just doing what we just did of like very intensely going back and forth nonstop for 5 hours. This is just what it's like being in the room with us.
That's
and we forget our manners sometimes.
Oh, I forgot to be civil and polite. Oh, sorry. Yeah, sincerely, no. This has been a lovely conversation. It's been really great sitting in talking with you guys about how good everything is.
I do that. I remember like a house party that me and Nick went to once where there just were Italian friends there. And then after a while, it was just like, why do these two guys know all the Italian political parties?
Oh, friend, sit down.
And with that, we will catch you on the bonus feed. Ciao, ciao.
Bye-bye.
Bye.